Welcome to the Songs of Note podcast, where we talk about the songs we love and the stories behind them. I'm your host, Ryan Gregg.
Hey, this is Ryan. Thank you so much for joining me for the Songs of Note podcast today. If you've listened to the show before, you know that I love some Nirvana. I love some 90s. And you know what? If you are here, then I'm guessing maybe you love some Nirvana and Kurt Cobain stories as well. They're just one of my favorite bands. And so there's an interesting thing to me that we kind of talked about in the interview today. But, for me growing up, bands like the Beatles are huge. And you've got rock stars like Jim Morrison or Mick Jagger. You've got these famous people. And then all of a sudden, you're growing up and you're listening to music. I was growing up listening to music. And then you've got bands like Pearl Jam and Nirvana. And they're, at the time, I didn't think about how they were connected in the same way as those historical bands as well. And so when someone like Kurt Cobain passed away, he was immediately put into the category of rock stars who've passed away. And he became kind of a thing, an icon, this thing that a lot of people knew about, or they knew his work, but not a lot of people knew him. And so in today's interview, I got to chat with Carrie Montgomery, who was friends with Kurt and spent a lot of time with him and knew his family, and her brother Craig was the Nirvana tour manager, did sound for them. So she just spent a ton of time with him. And I reached out to her, and she was super kind and willing to come on the show and talk about her memories of Kurt. She's started a podcast that you should check out called Leave a Message. And so this is interesting to me in the fact that here's someone who personally interacted with one of the most famous musicians of the 90s and had a personal interaction with it, which is what I want to know about. What was he like as a person? And then, too, it's cool to hear some of these stories about, she was there for some really cool moments and events. But three, she talked about how she's processed all the events that happened and how she has dealt with things like grief and how she's processed personally how to move on in some ways from dealing with hard stuff. And so this is just a really interesting interview for me, getting to chat with Carrie. She was super kind because I messed up the time for this interview like a couple times, and she was really nice about being able to accommodate it. So special shout out to Carrie. But this is a great interview, and would love for you to check out her podcast, Leave a Message. Let's head on over to the interview now. This is Carrie Montgomery. Well, hey, Carrie, thank you so much for coming on the podcast to chat today. It's great to meet you today.
Hi, you too, Ryan. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, for sure. And I appreciate you being willing to connect via the internet and be mm-hmm. like, yeah, I'll hop on this podcast and talk to this guy I've never met. So thank you for doing that. I appreciate it.
Yeah, sure.
So I'd love to just ask you some questions about what it was like knowing Kurt, knowing Nirvana, and just mm-hmm. some things around that time. So for starters, yeah. where did you grow up? Are you from Seattle originally?
I mean, kind of. I lived here when I was a little kid. My parents got divorced when I was two, and my brother Craig and I lived with our mom, and our dad lived in Seattle, and then our mom remarried a few times after that, and we moved around a bunch as kids, but we always came to Seattle to visit our dad. And then I've lived here pretty much solid since, like high school or something. So I consider myself a Seattleite, although as a child, I lived a few different places. But yeah, I'm a Seattleite.
Which I'm jealous. I'm from Dallas, so our scenery is very different. You have much prettier scenery there.
Well, that's arguable in the winter. Yeah, that's fair.
Well, I'd love to talk about how you first got involved with like the Seattle music scene. Like, what was your introduction to that scene and music in the area?
Right. Well, I went to high school in a suburb of Seattle. It's about like 10 or 15 minutes away, called Renton. And I was in high school, and one of my girlfriends started coming to Seattle, to the big city. She ended up going to kind of an all ages club, and she, met a guy who was in a band. And then a few of our friends started coming to the city on the weekends to go to these all ages shows and see bands. And
what year was this ish, would you say?
Right. Yeah. I mean, God, this was the early to mid 80s,
okay.
Like the late early 80s.
Okay, cool.
Yeah. So, and then I started dating a musician, someone named Scott Vanderpool. We're still friends to this day. He's a musician and on-air radio person, mm-hmm. has been forever. And then I guess, yeah, I just started meeting more and more people in the city and just started, you know, hanging out in the city and being a young person, meeting people in the music community.
What was that like, just as far as being around all this music? Like, to me, like as somebody who was nowhere near it, it seemed like Seattle, mm-hmm. was just the epicenter of all great music for a short time there, and probably longer than I was aware of. But did you get to go to a ton of cool shows during that time?
Sure. Yeah, I did. And then after Scott, I started dating Mark Arm. He had just started a band called Mudhoney. Yeah. Right. And he had been in a band called Green River before that. And I mean, as young people, I was probably 21, I guess, when I started going out with Mark. And to the best of my recollection, we went out like most nights of the week to see bands in all kind of different small tiny venues. We saw Soundgarden a lot. We saw the Screaming Trees a lot. We saw, all of them.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. So did you ever see Green River?
I did. Yeah. I saw Green River before I knew Mark. I had a friend who had a crush on him and I ended up going to one of their shows, but it must've been like a record release show because they brought out this huge green cake on stage. It had a ton of green frosting on it. And I was wearing my favorite, like black, of course, Betsy Johnson dress. And I was wearing these black patent leather Fluvogs. There was this shoe store in Seattle, I think it's still here, called Fluvogs, and they had a very specific aesthetic. Mm-hmm. And I went home that night with green frosting, just caked all over my shoes and my dress. And I, for some reason, had a resentment against Mark about it.
Oh, funny.
And so, yeah, it was kind of funny that we ended up together later on. But he was good friends with Bruce and John from Sub Pop. And one day they called Mark and just said, "Hey, could you come out tonight to the Vogue, this small club downtown, and check out this band with us? We're thinking about putting out a single by them." And so Mark and I went to the show, and there was like five people there, and the band was Nirvana. And Kurt really idolized Mark because of Green River, I think. And so he just started, we all just became friends, you know, at that time. And it just was very organic. And then my brother ended up becoming their sound engineer and tour manager in a completely different setting. Like, he and I didn't end up in the same place through the same pathway. You should have him on and tell the story. But anyway, we became friends with Kurt. Yeah. Okay. And he just started like showing up at our apartment. This was the olden days of landlines and,
no text messages,
writing your phone number down on a piece of paper and giving it to someone. So Kurt just started showing up at our house, our apartment, and, you know, listening to records and just being a person. Mm. And that was that. And Kurt and his girlfriend, his long-term girlfriend, Tracy, mm-hmm. and Mark and I all kind of broke up around the same time. And so Kurt and I just started hanging out all the time and just, doing, he didn't live in Seattle, but he would come to, he would come to the city a lot, and we just would, go to shows and do Nirvana stuff and,
That's awesome. Okay. So I'm curious, about, Mark Arm and his impression of Nirvana at the time, because he would have been in the band that this new kid was interested in, right? I mean, am I hearing that right?
For sure. Oh yeah.
Do you remember how you guys looked at Nirvana at the time? Like, was it like, "Oh, these guys are awesome," or is it just, "Oh yeah, they're pretty good," or like, do you remember any of that? How you felt?
We looked at them very differently. At that time. Now you have to keep in mind, like, the aesthetic. I wasn't like some huge punk rocker. I wasn't a huge punk rock fan or a punk rock aficionado or anything, but Mark really was. And I think Mark thought the name Nirvana was, I mean, I shouldn't speak for him. This is to the best of my recollection. Sure. So forgive me. And, you know, to tell you the truth, I thought it was a little bit funny myself. We just weren't from, like, the word Nirvana just conjured up a very, like, hippie kind of, you know, aesthetic that we just didn't subscribe to at that time.
Okay.
So that was the first blocker for both of us, for him more than me, I believe. Okay. And then he just wasn't really that enthralled. He wasn't that taken with them at that time.
Yeah.
And I had more of an affinity for the kind of the eccentricity of the visual. Super tall guy.
Right, on bass. Yep.
And then just like, who are these? What is this? But I think I liked the music more than he did. I can't remember. I wish I could remember the songs that they played back then. But, you know, this was pre-Bleach. So there was some really poppy stuff and then some really heavy stuff. And I think from what I remember, the conversation with Mark, it was something just like they can't decide what they are or something. And I'm like, they seem really nice. I like those guys. And so I didn't have the same criteria of judgment as Mark did. But
that's interesting. So that you're kind of answering the thing that I was curious about. So like I'm somebody who it was a teenager in the 90s and loved them. And then since has gone way back into the deep catalogs and the demos and all that. So like their early stuff for me, like it's hard to hear that there was such incredible promise in their very, very early recording. So I'm always like curious about how people saw them to where they got to so quickly on Bleach and then Nevermind. So that's interesting. So I think part of this and part of the reason for me, you know, wanting to chat with you is there's a weird element of, you know, we're living in a time of the 90s, you're living in a time where all of a sudden, you're doing rock music. People are doing rock music and they're doing rock music in the same way that bands like the Beatles did. And they're doing things that like the Doors did. They're carrying on their tradition. And you've got these rock icons, John Lennon or Jimi Hendrix or Jim Morrison, all these people. And then for me, it wasn't until like after Kurt's death that it was like, oh man, Nirvana did the thing that all these other people are doing. And now he is in the group of famous musicians who are past and who are going to be revered.
And at age 27.
At age 27, which is crazy. And so in one, in one aspect, he shoots to the top of, he's lumped with those people. But I was specifically curious to talk with you because you knew him before he was this thing. I never knew the guy. None of us like knew him, but everybody's curious about him. So I'm curious about, you know, what was he like as a person or as somebody to be around? And did you like hanging out with him? What are your memories of him, I guess?
Oh, gosh. Of course. Yeah. I mean, to me specifically, he was really nice. He was always very loving, really supportive. It was super funny. I mean, you know, he could be pretty crabby, like he was pretty moody, but he didn't take it out on me. It was always just like, he was a little, you know, discontent at times with whatever, but I never felt... It was never hard to be around him for me. I could metabolize his grouchiness easily. I'm sure I was not a picnic every moment of my existence either. He was really fun. He was really artistic and he was really thoughtful. And he, two sisters and he had one sister that was much, much younger than him. And he always wanted to, we would go down to his mom's and hang out with his little sister. And he wanted to get her special birthday presents and stuff. And, you know, one year for Christmas, he gave me a trip to New York when they were on SNL. That was my Christmas present one year. I mean, he was just
did you
like,
go to that?
He was, I did. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. The 92, the 1992 taping, that one?
The first time they were on. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. What was that like? That's crazy.
Yeah. It was a trip. I mean, he knew that I had at that time, my celebrity crush was Keanu Reeves. It might still be. I can't confirm or deny, but Keanu was supposed to be the host on their show. And so he, for Christmas, gave me...
Oh, that's great.
Me and his mom, yeah. And we went together and stayed in the same room and stuff. But then when I got there, I found out that Keanu had to cancel. He was filming a movie. So I was a little bit disappointed. I mean, it was still an interesting experience, for sure. It was cool to see how they film the show and all of that. Yeah. And, you know, his mom had never, I don't think she'd ever been on a plane before.
Oh, wow.
And so he wanted me to be with her and help her navigate the mean streets of New York City.
That's awesome. That's totally cool. So,
yeah.
Do you, how did you sense the relationship was between him and his mom? Did they get along? I was always curious about that dynamic too.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh God. Yeah, of course. Yeah. They adored each other. I mean, the way that you hear him would, I think, the way it was portrayed in the press. I mean, you know, family dynamics are complicated. Yeah. It's not all perfect. Sure. It's not all terrible. I mean, they had an immense amount of love and concern for each other, of course. Mm. And she was super proud of him. And he was really excited to have her be there and see them. And, you know, Courtney was there. And yeah, it was an interesting time. Luckily, Dave Grohl's mom and sister came and they stayed in the city. So when you do SNL, you're there for a full week before the taping of the show. And so we went for the full week. And so they did a bunch of stuff at MTV, and Kurt and Courtney and I did a lot of extracurricular activities. Mm. And so Wendy, Kurt's mom, got to hang out with Dave's mom and do normal like mom things. She, you know, we couldn't so really take her to do everything we were doing.
Sure. That's so funny, like, to think of the rock band moms hanging out, celebrating the fact their kids are on SNL. That's so, I mean, that part is so cool.
Yeah, it's pretty wild. And I haven't seen Dave's series, The Cradle to the Stage, but I would love to. And I haven't read his book yet either.
I just finished it. It was great. It was really good.
Is it? Yeah, sure. Dave is the best. I've always been rooting for Dave and just so happy for all of his success. And even back then, you know, I was pretty close to him at a certain time, you know, back in the olden days. And he was always just a really genuine person. Mm.
When you think about Kurt and knowing him for the time that you did, like, what, I guess the question is, like, what do you think it was about him that made people connect to him and connect to, like, to him as an individual or to his art? Like, there's so many bands and there were so many popular people to choose, and they would have never been the ones that I would have suspected that it would have risen to the top. Like, mm-hmm. Do you have any thoughts on why you think people connect so much to Kurt specifically?
It's hard to say that, having been so close. Mm. You know, and I loved Nirvana. I was such a Nirvana fan. You know, Mark would go on tour and he would come home, and there were two records that would be in front of the turntable that he knew that I were the only two records that I listened to the whole time he was gone. And one of them was Bleach. And I don't know. I mean, why does anyone connect to anyone? Mm. I mean, it's just like a vibe, or there's some common themes that resonate with a lot of people at once, or there's just like the aesthetic and the actual song structure, I think, is a very enticing, you know, quiet, loud, quiet, slow, fast, slow. Like, we've seen it, you know, Pixies, we've seen Beatles, whatever. It's like, it's a formula that works. And he just wrote some great songs, you know, I mean, definitely. Nevermind, you know, Teen Spirit was just, that was the song, you know, that was the thing. And, I was with him during the time, you know, when they started the tour for Nevermind. And by the time they got to Seattle on Halloween, it had gone.
Blew up.
I actually got to tell him that that Nevermind had gone gold. Ugh. It was my friend Susie, who worked for DGC, and I drove down to Portland and met them. And they had a show down there. And Susie had just found out from the label. And she was like, do you want to tell him? And I said, yeah. So I told him, and he didn't believe me.
Really?
So, yeah, I mean, that was a wild, it just happened, you know, while they were on tour, you know, you're in such an insulated
whirlwind
back then. Yeah. No smartphones. And so you're just doing shows and driving around in your van. Mm. And then all of a sudden, you know, when they got to Seattle for Halloween, Kurt and I went to get some money out of his ATM, and he couldn't believe the number. Like, he didn't know.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Yeah, he didn't know. And so he's looking at the receipt, and I was just like, what's wrong? You don't have any money? I have money. And he's just like, no, that's not it. <That's> I go, good. Well, let's go shopping, you little we're downtown. I'm like, let's go to Nordstrom. Yeah. But he, we actually went to a sex shop and he bought a blow up doll to wear as his Halloween costume on stage that night.
That's that's so crazy. So yeah, in like timeline for people listening, so the album came out in I think September 1991. So a month and a half later, they've already hit gold. So just blew up right out of the gate.
Back then, it was a big deal. Yeah, because there was nothing on the internet. There wasn't even Napster. So this is all physical sales.
Gosh, in real time.
Yeah, and so they were doing, you know, the Paramount, I think, was the biggest venue on that tour, and so they found out pretty soon that they were too big for the venues that they were in at that time. And
that's crazy.
Teen Spirit was on MTV constantly, and it was wild. We spent the night in a hotel that night downtown and fell asleep with the TV on MTV, and I woke up like 50 times during the night to them playing Teen Spirit.
Wow.
It was on every hour. Oh, probably, man.
How crazy. So were you at the Paramount show on Halloween?
Yeah.
The one song that sticks out to me from that performance is I think it was "Come As You Are," where they start. He starts tuning up, and then he realizes he's not getting the guitar in tune, and so they just go with it. And he does the whole thing like screaming, making it like making it like a moment out of, instead of just can't get the guitar right. He starts screaming out of tune too, and they do the whole song. And this one, if I'm remembering right, that was one of my favorite parts of that whole concert. But that's for people listening. You can listen to that concert. You can buy it, you can stream it, it's on all the places. So it's just cool.
They're doing a screening. There's a screening here coming up showing the whole film, which I've never seen, to tell you the truth.
It's great. It's great. Okay, so when your brother Craig was on tour with them, do you have any memories about like talking to him, or did you hear from him at all on, man, I'm on tour and it's like this, or like, would y'all keep up? Did you have that kind of relationship or how? Or no?
You know, again, like there was no, when someone was gone, there wasn't communication like there is now. You couldn't text, you couldn't call. One time he came home from tour. God, I can't remember if it was Nirvana though. I don't know. You should have Craig on. He's, you know, he is so smart and he has such a great memory. He would remember your story about Kurt's tuning.
Okay.
He would know what guitar you're talking about.
Okay. All right. I love
that. I can't remember. I know that one time Craig was on tour with Jeff Buckley and I called Craig on the tour bus and he had a big brick. He was one of the first people to have that big brick cell phone thing. And I talked to Jeff Buckley
on the tour bus
on a cell phone.
Did you really?
It was a big deal back then.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's crazy. Man, that is wild.
I guess. Yeah,
that's cool. Okay, so thinking about knowing the band and then they blew up and got popular. I'm curious for the fame aspect, not so much of the band, but how did people's perception of them change? Like, did you see people start interacting with them differently, like worshiping them, or like how did that change just to like what you observed, or did it change?
I mean, it's hard to know because I wasn't, you know, I wasn't in the general population. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like I was inside the bubble. So I know that like when he and I would go out around, you know, in Seattle, go to a show, a local show, and people would come up and talk to him a lot, I would just be irritated. Mm-hmm. Just like, can you please shut up? You know, we're trying to watch a show. Mm-hmm. And it just never occurred to me that he was. It occurred to him though. I mean, there were times when he would say to me that he wanted to, you know, change his hair color a lot or wear disguises. He wants to be able to go to 7-Eleven without some, you know, truck driving redneck wanting to talk to him about his record or whatever. Like he wanted to, you know, at his funeral, I think Danny Goldberg said it or someone from the label said it. Like he wanted the most points and he wanted the most royalties and he wanted the best record deal, but he also wanted to be completely anonymous, you know, not have any of the responsibility of fame. So, I mean, you know, and everyone that I knew back then knew him. So it wasn't like strangers were like, oh, hey, can I come hang out with you guys tonight? It was like, oh, Patty Schimmel is coming over or Marco Collins or whatever. It's just like, just our group of friends that knew him. So
that's neat.
But I did feel kind of protective of him sometimes. Like we'd be out, we'd be out and he'd have to walk through a crowd and I would kind of, you know, walk in front, like be his bodyguard a little bit, which is ridiculous because I'm not a big person, but I was just like, he didn't want to be the bad guy. He didn't want to, you know, tell people no or have to.
Gotcha.
Whatever. I would just kind of try to be his Sherpa sometimes.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Through life. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So I found a quote and the internet said it. So you'll have to tell me if it's true or not, but it said from you about Kurt, he made women want to nurture and protect him. He was a paradox in that way because he also could be brutally and intensely strong. And at the same time, he could appear fragile and delicate. And so I'm curious mm-hmm. if you said that, what do you mean by that? And why did that come to mind
mm-hmm.
when you said it?
I think he got a lot of that stuff when he was married to Courtney too, like after the fact of like, oh, Courtney's the boss.
Mm.
And he had very strong, you know, opinions and ideas, and he knew how he wanted things to be, and that's the way they were going to be. He wasn't a pushover. He wasn't just like a, you know, he had very specific, you know, plans and ideas and taste.
Mm.
You know, he wanted his stuff to be a certain way. So he was a lot of stuff, you know. He was fragile and I don't want to say fragile, I'm vulnerable. He was vulnerable and, you know, emotional and kind, but then he could also really exert some, you know, he could be a little bit brutal at times. I've definitely seen him hurt people's feelings on purpose,
gotcha.
You know, but it was, you know, he was under duress a lot of times too. Like,
yeah,
it was a lot.
Yeah.
You know, it was a lot for him.
I can't imagine. Do you remember any specific point where you wondered or you knew like that, like drugs were being involved and maybe for the negative, that was negatively affecting him, or like, did you see him start acting different at some point or anything like that?
Oh, well, yeah, for sure. Of course. After I got back from New York from the Saturday Night Live thing, I got clean. So I got sober. God, that was, I don't know the month, but so I got sober and we were all in Seattle. Kurt and Courtney lived, you know, down the street from me. And I was intentionally not. I had a kid. They had a kid. I was in touch with, so my friend Patty Schemmel was dating their nanny. And so I was in touch with them. And we would meet up at the park and the kids, our babies would play, see each other, whatever. But I wasn't around Kurt and Courtney because I was trying to stay clean. I was trying to stay away from drugs. And so I think during that time is really like his most intense, noticeable decline. And so I wasn't specifically in person with him at that time.
Mm. That makes sense.
Yeah. But I knew what was going on. He was like, my, you know, my brother was still in that camp.
Yeah.
And like I said, I was friends with Patty and their nanny. And I knew just, you know, inherently what the vibe was.
Yeah.
But I just wasn't physically present because I was trying to do some self-preservation.
Gotcha. That makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so having liked them at Bleach and then knowing the band at Nevermind, where did things go in the in utero phase? One, did you like the record? And two, did you continue to interact much with the band around that time?
Mm-hmm. I think that was when I kind of had retreated, you know, from everything. Yep. You know, I was trying to calibrate my life and stay alive, essentially. So I love the record. I mean, it wasn't the same to me as the other two, just because I wasn't so involved and present in the day-to-day Nirvana stuff anymore. But I, of course, I loved it. I mean, there was an undercurrent of sadness to me that maybe hadn't been there before. And I think, you know, all the Vanity Fair stuff and all the Francis being born stuff, like all that happened. And it was different. I felt like it was a chapter of them that I just wasn't so personally immersed in.
Gotcha. When you're, it's interesting hearing you talk about your interaction with him specifically, with Kurt as a person, as an individual. I want to tell you my experience that is unique, and I've only experienced it twice. But once was recently, and one time I was buying it was some Nirvana book, and Kurt's face was big on the cover. The used bookstore, and the guy checking out the book like looked at it for a long time, and he goes to check it out. He's like, you know, he's the only rock star who's ever died that I cried over, and I was like, you know, oh man. So that, but I'm like, you don't know me at all. And that just that emotion was evoked from somebody to me audibly who doesn't know. And I thought that was interesting. And the second time was recently, I had a photographer on the show named Martin Goodacre, who took a famous picture of Kurt, and he mailed me a copy of this picture of Kurt. So I was taking it to a frame shop, and the lady is looking at the picture and she's staring at it, and she's like, is that Kurt, you know, Cobain? I was like, yeah, you know, are you familiar, you know, with him? And she's like, well, I used to live in the area, and I grew up. And she goes on to tell me this whole story of how she grew up going to shows in Seattle in the 90s. And it was just interesting. I've never had any kind of interaction with people that I didn't know who just opened up about their life about a specific thing or individual like that. And it made me wonder if that was kind of the quality that people latched onto. Like, was there something, like, to your point, like, vulnerable about him that made people, I don't know, feel closer to him or more interested in him? Or I don't know. It's more of an observation than a question. I thought that was interesting. I wonder if you've had any kinds of interactions with people because of your, you knowing him, you know?
Yeah, definitely.
I bet.
Well, and also I think he really was such a physically, like aesthetically, such a beautiful person. I mean, he was just those ocean blue eyes and just, you know, he was just like, you know, and childhood photos of Kurt look exactly like my brother. And so I have to believe that there's probably a lot of people that look like, you know, that kind of Scandinavian looking, you know, blue eyes, blonde hair, sort of aesthetic that just feels there's some ancient, you know, there's some ancestry in there that just makes it seem that person seem familiar physically, I think, to a lot of people. But of course, yeah, I mean, I have a picture of Kurt and I actually from the show at the Paramount, and it's in a frame, and I always have it hung somewhere in my house. It's in my bathroom right now. But every time I move, the movers always say, whether they're young or old or whatever, just like, oh, is that you?
Oh,
is that
wow, Kurt? That's cool.
Oh, you were friends with, I mean, it's just, yeah, all the time. And, you know, I used to not really like to talk about it very much. And then I had an experience where I was at an event in LA, and I was seated next to Mickey Dolenz from the Monkees. Mm. And he was telling me a story. We were at this small venue seeing Brian Wilson. That's its whole own story. But
wow. Nice.
Yeah, I need a book deal, Ryan. So,
you do.
He was telling me firsthand stories about John Lennon. When Yoko exiled John Lennon to L.A., He would come kick it with Mickey Dolenz, and they would have parties and play music. And at one party, Mickey Dolenz, John Lennon, and Brian Wilson are all jamming in Mickey Dolenz's basement. Yeah, and so he's telling me the story, and I'm just thinking, like, this is really special to get a firsthand story about someone that's so, you know, multiple people that are really fascinating.
Yeah.
And I just decided, like, who am I to withhold these stories from people that enjoy hearing about Kurt or about Nirvana? But it's been a little bit touchy, you know, for a couple decades of, like, you don't want to, it's hard to mourn the loss of someone that's so publicly revered and loved, and everyone's telling stories like, oh yeah, I sold a piece of paper to Kurt in 1980 or whatever. It's like, it's just hard to. And then I just decided, you know, it's my truth and it's my story. Yep. It's my life. And I'm sure he would give me carte blanche to talk about anything in his life or my life or our lives together. So it just feels like it's such a beautiful thing to share and to honor his memory and to honor our friendship. And so I've just recently started being, you know, and on the podcast, my podcast and stuff, you know, just is starting to feel maybe enough time's gone by that I'm over it. I'm over caring what people think about my story or how I tell it. So,
well, I think that's amazing. And I appreciate you even being willing to come on today to talk about it, because it is a touchy thing when you're talking about being close to someone and who passed away. And I would only imagine that would conjure up feelings that are hard to deal with. And so I'm curious about how you started your podcast. It's called Leave a Message. Are there parts of that where you, from your podcast, where you are addressing things like on grief or like what's the purpose of the podcast and how'd you get that started?
Yeah. Well, like I said, I've been in recovery for, it'll be 24 years in December. And I live with one of my lifelong best friends, Janet, and we've been friends, raised our kids together. And we we work at the same company. We work for a recovery-based company, and we've both been doing a lot over the last few years, doing a lot of therapy about healing trauma, you know, and talking about addiction as a trauma response. And there's a lot of, you know, culturally, I think it's becoming much more mainstream to talk about this stuff, to talk about behavioral health, to talk about mental health, and to talk about substance use disorder without the stigma attached to it. Like people that use drugs or just throw away people and they're doing it to themselves and stuff. And so we're having these really rich conversations around healing and growing and identifying, you know, family systems and family dynamics as kids and how that manifests itself in people, and finding that there's a lot of common denominators and a lot of people in our recovery community. And so, and also Janet is my, you know, around my same age, and she was in Seattle back in the day, and we, you know, and we have a lot of stories. And so we decided that it would be cool to, you know, tell stories, and, you know, we laugh and we make fun of ourselves and we talk about a lot of people we know and talk about a lot of, you know, music and bands and whatever. And then we also talk about present day and what our lives look like and the stuff that we're learning and the stuff that we're, like, literally as human beings evolving and the work we're actually doing. You know, we're walking the walk, not just talking about doing the stuff. You know, we're doing the deep excavation of these old, you know, these, all this old conditioning that human beings have. So we decided to do a podcast, not really knowing what it was going to be or how, if people would listen. And we're just getting such amazing, huge responses from all people from all different areas of our lives, really enjoying the podcast. And we just recently had on our first guest, who is an old, lifelong dear friend of mine, Danny Bland, who is very involved in the music community and recovery community. And so
that's awesome.
You know, I was, my dear friend Mike McCready approached me, you know,
that's great,
asking me to have him on the podcast. So I mean, I think it's just going to be a really fun just a really fun exploration of a lot of different, you know, life experiences and healing, different healing modalities, and about recovery and just like the human experience. And I told, you know, I've told a couple Kurt stories on the podcast. They're just kind of intermittently peppered throughout, and we'll see, you know, we'll see. I've been, you know, trying to write a book for a minute, so we'll see. I don't know. We're just kind of going with the flow organically and seeing, you know how it is.
Yeah,
just
that's
seeing
awesome
how it goes. And we'll have some guests on, and we'll continue to just do it with the two of us. And, you know, we know each other so well, and it's just a really, it's really just cool to share, to be an open book and to be really vulnerable and to tell the truth, you know.
That's awesome.
A lot of us grew up in environments where we call it like reality deniers. You didn't talk about, you know, things that were very obviously happening in your family or within yourself. And, you know, our parents are of that same generation of, you know, you have to pretend everything's okay all the time.
Yeah.
All that stuff. So it's like a, I think it's stuff, you know, a lot of people seem to relate to it.
Well, that's very cool. And for people listening, it's called Leave a Message. You can find it on all podcast platforms.
Another thing I'm doing is I'm creating a little eBay auction of some Nirvana memorabilia, some Kurt memorabilia, just like some stuff. And so it'll be on my brother Craig's eBay, probably in the next like week. It's not up quite yet. I'm still getting stuff together, but I think it's going to be a fun little thing. Lots of unique memorabilia, if anybody wants to check it out, Craig. So it'll be Craig Montgomery on eBay.
That's awesome.
So it should be up like in the next week. Yeah.
That's totally cool. That's totally cool. Well, so last question, when you, I have one more quote from you in talking talking about Kurt after the fact. And you said he turned into this thing that has nothing to do with who he was. And so now that you're after all this has passed and you've moved on and you're moving on and still processing things, when you think back to the way that people have turned this person that you knew into like an icon and like people like me who have never met him, who think of him in a certain ways, what did you mean when you said that he has turned into this thing that has nothing to do with who he was? Do you remember what you meant when you said that?
Oh, gosh. I don't remember what I was referring to specifically at that time. Mm. We can speculate so many different things, you know, just like the commercialization of him and the merch, you know, all the merch. You walk by Hot Topic.
So much.
Nirvana shirts. Right. So I think just, again, like to go back to what that person said at his funeral, like, you know, he wanted all the success, but without any of the, you know,
ramifications.
Without the commercialization of him as a person or him, his music. But I think, and I don't think he was trying, you know, back then everyone was calling him like the voice of a generation and the spokesperson of the Gen X or whatever. Was it Gen X? Are we Gen X or Gen?
Yeah.
All that stuff. I think it was a lot of responsibility for him. I mean, he was 25 years old or what, you know, like when I have a kid who's 28 and when I look at him, it's just like, gosh, I would hate to have the whole world's, you know, just
on their shoulders
from them, scrutinizing him. Yeah. So I think he just didn't have the, I don't know specifically what I was referring to at that time, but I could think of a million different things of that. I don't think I'm sure he said it himself. Like, I don't want to, you know, I think a lot of famous people don't want the fame.
Yeah.
They don't want to lose the ability, the autonomy of being able to walk down the street.
Right.
You know, you're imprisoned by it. And I think that was early on. He felt that. I mean, he expressed that to me about wanting to, you know, because I did his hair and he always wanted to like change his hair and do a disguise. Like if he was saying stuff like that early on, he was feeling the loss of his privacy.
Yeah.
It's a lot more than people think it's going to be. You know, you see celebrities like lashing out at paparazzi and you think, well, you know, when you decided to become an actor, when you decided to become a musician, you agreed to take on this part. And that's not the truth.
Right.
No one knows that it's going to be like that. No one knows that people are going to be camped outside your house, taking pictures of your baby and stuff. Man. So
no kidding.
I think, I don't know. I mean, what book was that in? Was it in Heavier Than Heaven or?
I think that was, I hit copy and I don't remember where. I think it was from
a
newspaper or Heavier Than Heaven. I don't remember which one.
I think I've only talked to two people about their Nirvana books. I think I talked to Charles about his and then Everett True.
Okay.
I think those are the only two people I've ever been in their book in the interviews. And even back then I was still very like skeptical about talking about stuff too much, you know.
Well, if you ever do put out a book, I'd love to read it. I'm sure other people would as well. And for people listening, be sure and check out the podcast, Leave a Message. Carrie, I'm so grateful for your time, getting to hear your stories and look forward to checking out the podcast more as well. Thank you so much for coming on today.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to the Songs of Note podcast. Be sure and subscribe so you don't miss an episode. See you next time.